This week on Vox Talks, which countries in Africa really are lands of opportunity? Welcome to Vox Talks from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. Growth and economic prospects for millions of people in Africa have improved dramatically. But if you are born in Africa, how much does the family you are born into still determine your life chances? An ambitious research project has investigated intergenerational mobility in 26 countries in Africa, and it finds some startling differences, both among countries and within them. Today I've come to meet one of the authors, Elias Papayoanou of the London Business School, who is also a CEPR Fellow. Elias, welcome to Vox Talks.
Thanks, Tim.
What exactly are we measuring here?
So intergenerational mobility reflects, in our application, the likelihood that kids, boys or girls, coming from families who do not have any completed education, let's call them for simplicity literate, will manage to complete at least primary schooling. This would be a measure of upward absolute mobility. Likewise, we can think of a measure of downward mobility, which will reflect the likelihood that boys or girls coming from families with completed primary schooling or higher will not manage to complete primary schooling. It is a very interesting concept because it reflects the transmission of education from the previous generation to the current one.
And in general terms, when we are measuring intergenerational mobility, what about a country are we measuring?
There is nowadays a lot of research trying to measure intergenerational mobility in income or in wealth, mostly in the United States and some other rich countries, because it is of vital importance in today's world to understand why there are very big differences in income or wealth across countries and also within big countries such as the United States.
And I notice here you chose to measure mobility in education. As you say, when it's done in Europe or in the United States, it's usually an income. Why have you made that decision?
So thanks for your question. It allows me to give some clarifying aspects here. In the past 5 to 6 years, there has been super fascinating work by Raj Chetty, Nate Hendren, Emmanuel Saez, and various collaborators looking in the United States, comparing the income of parents with that of kids using proprietary data provided to those researchers by the IRS. Therefore, Chetty and team have managed to compile measures of the intergenerational transmission of income looking across a very large sample of Americans. And this was done thanks to the provision of confidential data from the government to those researchers. This thing is very hard to do in many other parts of the world. First of all, in many parts of the world, such as Africa, for example, very few Africans, less than 1% of the population, submit tax returns. And there are very important issues regarding tax evasion or tax hiding. So we are constrained if we were to look in Africa or in other frontier or emerging markets, because the quality of the underlying income data is not there. Moreover, in countries such as the one in sub-Saharan African countries, education is a critical ingredient of the transmission of status from the previous generation to the current. A third reason why we look in education is that since the pioneering work of Gary Baker and Toms, actually, when we think about the investments that parents make in their kids, education is the very first thing that comes to mind.
To collect your data, though, you've had to compile data from many different sources across many countries and across a long time. How satisfied are you with the rigor of your data and that the data from different sources is comparable?
Although economists are greedy animals, so typically they strive for even better data or even higher quality data, I must admit that after 4 years of phenomenal work of my collaborators, Alberto Lezina at Harvard, Stelios Michalopoulos at Brown, and Sebastian Hoban currently in Stockholm, we have managed to process close to 80 censuses conducted from 26 African countries. Some of those censuses were conducted in the 70s, some of them in the early 80s. So conducting a cohort analysis, we can measure the education of Africans born even in the 20s, the 30s, so before African independence, and compare how their education compares to that of the next generation. So although clearly one could ask for more, we are processing for our analysis for the paper that we have circulated and a couple of companion papers that we are currently working on, millions of observations covering a large span of African countries, covering cohorts that were born both before, during, or during independence, the initial decades post-independence when Africa was left behind or when things fell apart, and also the more recent period where many African countries are experiencing robust growth.
There are some countries that are notable success stories, very high mobility. Which ones are we talking about here?
Bearing in mind that we talk about education, the clear success stories is South Africa and Botswana, two countries in the southern part of the continent that are typically considered success stories. This, of course, doesn't mean that there are not significant challenges in both countries. But in both countries, and Botswana is a very interesting case because Botswana at independence starts with very low levels of education, but actually quite quickly, the kids of parents who do not have primary education manage quickly to acquire education. So the likelihood that we estimate that kids born from illiterate parents in Botswana, that they will manage to complete at least primary schooling, exceeds 70%. While for some other countries, mostly in the Sahel region, south of the Sahara, for example, in Burkina Faso or in Ethiopia, they're still abysmally low.
These are the opposite end of the scale, aren't they? They've got
exactly.
Low upward mobility and high downward mobility. These are located in different parts of Africa?
There are significant differences across countries on both upward and downward mobility. To a first approximation, the countries of the Sahel exhibit the lowest levels of upward mobility and the highest levels of downward mobility. The latter meaning that even for families that do have some schooling acquired, like completed primary, their offsprings are actually quite likely not to complete primary school. So on the one side of the spectrum, we have countries in the Sahel, like Ethiopia and Burkina Faso and Mali, with very low levels of upward mobility. And the mirror image of that are the countries in the southern part of the continent, mostly South Africa and Botswana, that exhibit high levels of upward mobility and likewise low levels of downward mobility. Western African countries, for example, Ghana, will be somewhere in the middle. And we provide in the paper a ranking, if you like, of upward and downward mobility of those 26 African countries, also distinguishing between rural households and urban households, and also distinguish between boys and girls.
If we did this sort of analysis in Europe, for example, you see the results, and they're quite close. They're different, but they're quite close. How big is the difference between the high and low mobility countries in Africa?
We are not making any analogy of African countries with non-African countries. And there are very good reasons doing so. For example, since you mentioned Europe, most European citizens do acquire at least primary schooling and even complete secondary or tertiary education. It just seems that in the period where we look at, most of the action in the case of sub-Saharan African countries tends to be at this margin. Parents who do not have any formal schooling, kids who manage to complete at least primary schooling. We also have some offsprings of individuals whose parents have completed primary schooling, who either managed to complete primary schooling or many of them, especially in the Sahel, do not manage to do so. So we restrict our comparison to different African countries because although the history of the region is quite heterogeneous, there are some similarities. And what we find is that Western African countries have done okay, the countries in the Sahel have not managed to do well, and Botswana and South Africa stand as the success stories, at least on this dimension.
You mentioned that you compared the outcomes for boys and girls. Is there a big difference?
Overall, we observe a gender gap with a bit higher levels of mobility for boys as compared to girls, although these differences are not very large. For example, if you were to compare them with difference in mobility between rural and urban households, there we observe starkly large differences in almost all countries with much higher levels of upward mobility for urban households as compared to rural households, which perhaps could explain why many Africans in the past decades are flocking to the big African megacities, because there the likelihood that the kids will acquire at least primary education are much higher than in the countryside.
You mentioned this urban and rural distinction. How granular do you get?
We go as granular as the data allows us to go. Actually, a novelty of our approach, we look within countries across regions. So, for example, the data allows us to conduct the analysis and compile estimates of upward and downward mobility in education for 102 administrative units in Ghana, for 110 administrative units in Mozambique. And what we document and what we find is that there are very large differences in upward and downward mobility across regions in the same country. And I think this is quite important because it shows that simply comparing countries is not particularly useful because there are very big differences in educational opportunity within countries.
Your data goes a long way back, pre-independence, but you seem to have found that countries at the top of the distribution here have stayed at the top, and at the bottom, they've stayed at the bottom. Why is this?
We conduct some cohort analysis, so we compare individuals who were born, let's say, in the 60s and the 70s, and compare them with individuals who were born in the 80s and the 90s. Although for an analysis, we use millions of observations of data. Once we start cutting the data by cohort and cutting the data by gender, by rural-urban status, distinguishing across regions, and since we work with representative samples, which typically is 10% of the underlying census, we are constrained by the number of observations. So what we document regarding the time series across cohorts is that overall educational opportunity is somewhat increasing on average on African countries. But again, this masks considerable heterogeneity, with some countries moving up and converging quite fastly, while some other countries and some other regions are being lagging behind.
Would you have expected more convergence over half a century now?
The typical answer of an economist is yes and no. A lot of research looking on Africa, some by us, some by other leading scholars, such as Nathan Nunn at Harvard and Jim Robinson at Chicago, document a lot of inertia and a lot of persistence on African development. So in this regard, perhaps our key descriptive result, which is that upward mobility relates to the stock of education of the old, with the association of being strongly positive, perhaps it's not surprising given this previous and ongoing research documenting significant inertia. However, in most economic theories, one should expect converge with some lagging region quickly catching up. What we document is that there is perhaps some convergence, but this convergence is very slow. It does not happen in all African countries. So in some countries, we have fast convergence, Botswana and South Africa. In some other countries, there's no convergence. In some other countries, such as Mali and Ethiopia and Burkina Faso, we even have divergence. And this is how we view our research, as documenting in the first part of the paper some facts, in the second part of the paper documenting the main correlates of the huge discrepancy in upward and downward mobility across 2,800 African regions. In the third part of our research, we try to examine whether regions have a causal effect on upward mobility, or simply some better regions attract more talented Africans or Africans of higher ability. And we hope that in future research, we will shed more light on the gender difference, on rural-urban migration, which is something very interesting to understand African countries today. And also we leave for future research, by us or by others, to assess, for example, the role of schooling infrastructure or other infrastructure or national policies at the country level.
That I was going to ask you about. Is there anything that we can say in general about the characteristics, the infrastructure of the regions that have done well? And also, can we say anything about this being causal from the data you have?
Let me start with your first question. We conduct an exploration of the correlates of the large spatial differences in intergenerational mobility within countries. So we compare whether some features correlate with the huge discrepancy on mobility that we observe, for example, as I mentioned earlier, in Mozambique or in Ghana or in Botswana. We find that colonial investments, which overall in Africa were limited, have played a role in the sense that in those places where European colonizers or missionaries built schools or clinics, we observe much higher levels of mobility today. We further show that in places where the Europeans built roads and railroads, in these places actually attracted a lot of talented Africans, we do observe higher levels of mobility. We also find that some geographic features matter, mobility rates being higher in the coastline of Africa and especially close to capitals. So we characterize, if you like, the geography of intergenerational mobility upward and downward. Clearly, the correlations that we identify are not causal, but We just wanted to see whether those historical and geographical features that research has identified as significant contributors to African development play a role also in shaping the intergenerational transmission of education.
Can we say anything from what you found out about policies that might be effective in improving intergenerational mobility in Africa?
So regarding policies is a great question. And frankly, it's something that we leave for future research. So we believe that building on findings in the US and other industrial countries, future research could examine the role of country-level educational policies that different African countries have adopted at different periods in time. For example, compulsory primary education, the implementation of large school infrastructure projects. We're currently collecting data to shed some light on this aspect in the years to come. Let me stress here that we are massively constrained by data issues to address many of the exciting questions that you are asking.
I assume you're going to carry on with this research, but surely there comes a point at which you run into this wall that there just isn't the data in Africa.
That's a fair question. We are passionate about African development. We really believe that there is immense opportunity in this part of the world that was left behind in the years following African independence. There is a very active body of researchers, many young and very talented researchers that conduct very exciting research, way better than ours, if I'm allowed to say. We also see many political scientists and historians looking at this issue from their different, unique experience. So we believe that in the years to come, thanks to a lot of data collection and the combination of high-resolution data like the ones we are compiling with some historical data, some policy data, can share new insights that will be valuable for many African countries and other low-income and frontier economies that could adopt policies that have been working in some places or have not been working in some other places. And we really hope that our research and the data that we will make publicly available once our papers hopefully get accepted for publication will initiate a new wave of research that now will try to connect Africa's past and policies that the various African states implemented post-independence with educational mobility and opportunities.
Well, I know a lot of people are going to be looking at this with interest. Elias, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Tim. Thank you very much.
The paper we've been talking about is called Intergenerational Mobility in Africa, and the authors are Alberto Alessina, Sebastian Oman, Stelios Mikolopoulos, and Elias. And it's CEPR discussion paper 13497. And also on the same topic, you can read a Vox column with the same authors and the same title as well. That gives you a flavour of the research. If you don't have time to read the whole paper, you can get it from there. Next week on Vox Talks, a new history of economics and economists in the Second World War.
You realise that the whole war is obviously not just a military and political struggle, it's an economic one as well. And so economists in some places had a very key role. They had to work out how to finance the war, sometimes in the front line, sometimes just under intense political pressure and back lines. So a lot of them had very difficult times as well as very challenging ones.
You won't want to miss that, so subscribe on your podcast platform. Or remember, we're always at voxeu.org/vox-talks.